Hello and welcome to One-on-One with LAPA, the Legislative Analysis and Public Policy Association podcast series, where we have experts discuss key issues and emerging topics in the areas of public health and safety, and specifically in areas of substance use disorders and the criminal justice system. LAPA is funded by a grant from the Office of the National Drug Control Policy, Executive Office of the President. And just for full disclosure, neither the Office of National Drug Control Policy nor any federal instrumentality operate, control, are responsible or necessary endorse our podcast. Now that we've got the boring stuff out of the way, I'm Shan Kemper. I'm a senior legislative attorney with LAPA, and I'm your host today for our podcast on the topic of medication-based treatment for substance use disorders in correctional settings. And I am truly, genuinely honored to have our guest here today with us, Annie Ramsianu, who is the Director of Addiction and Mental Health for the Vermont Department of Corrections. And I am so, so happy for you to be here. She's an expert in her field, and she's going to be answering some questions on medication-based treatment and medication for addiction treatment in correctional settings. Thank you for being here today.
You are so very welcome, Chan.
Can you tell us a little bit about your background before we get started?
Sure. But before I do that, I want to say that I am equally honored to be the Legislative Analysis and Public Policy Association's guest today. And I am also so excited to be invited to speak about these issues that are also incredibly important to me personally and professionally.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome. I've always been interested in mental health, substance use, health and wellness since I was a teenager. And I always dreamed of working in my chosen profession. So it shouldn't be a surprise that one of my daily gratitude practices is reminding myself that dreams do come true.
And that that's wonderful.
Yeah, and that having vision and thinking big is such an important life skill. But the short story on how I got into this work is that I started working in the field of mental health and addiction treatment over 20 years ago. Initially, I worked with homeless Vermont youth and young adults who were typically involved, unfortunately, in the criminal justice system. My experience with the nexus of mental health and substance use disorders and the criminal justice system led to the development of a court-based treatment diversion program that was highly efficacious. And the results of the program caught the attention of the Shumlin administration and resulted in a gubernatorial appointment for myself to bring the program to a statewide scale. Yeah, it was momentous. Wow. When the work stemming from my initial appointment was concluded, I was offered the opportunity to stay working in the Department of Corrections, and my role as Director of Mental Health and Addiction Treatment Services was created.
They essentially kind of created the role because of the work that you did.
Correct.
Wow.
So in that role, I oversee and monitor the delivery of these services via a healthcare contractor, but my role is really much more expansive than just being a subject matter expert and contract monitor. And I've led many initiatives to change what we really understand healthcare is in a correctional system and then improve the delivery of those services.
Can we go back to your amazing background a little bit? I mean, you kind of glanced off of that, but you said you created a program that was like highly effective and had a lot. I mean, what did you do?
Well, the need was clear. And fortunately, I had a partner in crime, no pun intended, in a judge that was serving in the criminal court in Chittenden County, which is our most populous county in Vermont. Uh-huh. And he was dismayed that the defendants coming before him were just going through a revolving door, and that the nature of their offenses were very, very uniquely substance use related. So he was having that experience. And at the same time, obviously, as a therapist in the community serving this population, I was also experiencing the same. We both heard about each other and got together, and we devised a system by which he used his discretion at the bench to divert people immediately to me, still under the court's supervision. And then I had a very evidence-based, rigorous treatment protocol that all my staff were trained in, and we provided very tight coordination with the court, tight case management, and excellent clinical work. Okay. The results of that through a double-blind clinical randomized evaluation was that 85% of the individuals over a 3-year period of time did not recidivate.
85%?
85%.
That's like unheard of. That's
yeah, the normal, the control group, it was exactly the inverse. The control group, 85% of them who did not receive this treatment and this service recidivated. That was some big results. Really, yeah. I had no extra money. This did not come from a grant. This was simply two people coming together and innovating. How could we do better? What's our vision? And we laid this out. And so again, Governor Shumlin was very interested in that. Uh-huh. And we attempted to bring that statewide. So the program was called Pretrial Services. And I was the first and only Pretrial Services Director. Upon establishing the system, we did an analysis of diversion programs. The Attorney General's office had the majority of those programs. And we made a policy decision that it would be best to house all of those programs under that oversight.
That's pretty impressive. I'm assuming that has helped as you've transitioned to your role as director. That background?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it was my first foray into state government. So uh-huh. coming as from the community, from mm-hmm. a nonprofit world, adjusting to state government was certainly part of my learning curve.
Right.
And that definitely was a launching pad of being at the larger level of the system.
Okay. Wow. I imagine that also helped with the state's burgeoning opioid crisis.
And yes.
Because I know, I mean, like everywhere in the United States has been hit with the opioid crisis. I know exactly. Vermont has been sort of, well, at the forefront in terms of dealing with it. But I wonder how has that also impacted sort of your determination or your decision to start looking at medication for addiction treatment?
Well, your point is well taken. And, back to Governor Peter Shumlin, I mean, the opioid crisis in Vermont made national news.
Right.
It was sadly a big day about a really bad situation, but made national news when he delivered his famous State of the State.
Right. Right.
Yeah. After he was elected, and he named it as a public health crisis and framed it that way for the first time and started a national discussion. So, I mean, his leadership really heightened not only Vermont and Vermont policymakers of the intersection between the crisis and the criminal justice population, certainly the need for evidence-based policy interventions, but it really started the conversation nationally. So my original appointment as the pretrial services director was really his first leading strategy in how the state was going to start addressing this crisis.
Could you go elaborate a little bit more? Because you saying that triggered that reminder for me that I think he was one of the first state government officials in power to call it, start to move it away from this is a problem, a moral problem of people not being able to just, pull themselves up by their bootstraps and deal with their addiction. And this is a public health crisis, at which I think people in the medical field had started to understand, but our government officials maybe were not treating it as such. And that speech, I think, is famous for that.
Yeah, it is. And the old, saying, if you don't acknowledge you have a problem, well, then you're clearly never going to fix it.
Right.
So, I think it really was a seminal moment, in our state's history as well mm-hmm. as in the nation's. I think we should all recognize that and be grateful for his leadership because, the stigma surrounding this, admitting at that level of the system in his
right.
position that we had a problem, which kind of speaks to it's unmanageable. And
right.
admitting that vulnerability is not weakness, it's strength.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's easy. And it's easy for me to agree with you so many odd years later, but I imagine getting to that point in terms of acceptance was difficult in terms of the people around you and changing that. Was that a difficult thing with getting people to accept medication for addiction treatment in the correctional system? Was that similar? How did you get to that determination?
Yes. Fortunately, because the movement was started at the top of our leadership through the government, governor, we also have a very progressive and forward-thinking legislature, and I would say
okay.
population. So I think in that regard, a lot of the work that I think some states and some thought leaders have to tackle, you know, maybe was a little bit easier for me and for the others involved
in the initiatives.
But, you know, it really took about 5 to 6 years. The legislature started directing the department to initially convene study groups, which is a common practice. That was typically partnered with directing the department to pilot various intensities of buprenorphine treatment that were then supported by clinical advisory groups. And at the end of the day, you can obviously already know my story. The department was, as expected, charged with evaluating the efficacy of these pilots and then reporting out on the challenges and the learnings. Mm-hmm. But the writing was definitely on the wall, you know, 5 or 6 years in the making, that the goal of the legislature and of the leadership was to advance the implementation of opioid use disorder treatment in corrections. So, and I know this from my own national speaking with the National Governors Association, et cetera, you know, there still is a real lack of commitment to parity, which really was established along, you know, many years ago by the Domenici-Wellstone Act, you know, how we really interpret the Eighth Amendment, ADA, et cetera. So I do feel really blessed and grateful that, you know, in Vermont, I had more open ears and a willing legislative branch and certainly executive branch to hear how we could improve on things. So all of that resulted in the 2017-2018 in the development and passage of what is known as Act 176. Okay. And Act 176 was the first law in the nation regarding opioid use disorder treatment and the expansive, very expansive provision of MAT within the Department of Corrections.
Wow.
Yeah. It was the first law that established a statewide definition of OUD treatment for the entire Vermont populace and then upheld exactly the same definition for the incarcerated population.
Wow. That was at the forefront of changing the way people essentially treated, you know, substance use disorders in correctional settings.
Yeah. And even for the population, because this put it into law that this was not, you know, oh, you're just substituting one addiction for another.
Right.
It's good point, that this actually quantified and codified and supported the federal government's definition of opioid use disorders.
Right.
And that this was all a legitimate medical treatment.
Right.
And that this was a chronic disease. So it really elevated the conversation quite powerfully.
So was that a helpful spring in terms of using that as a springboard to my next question? How does that work out in practice?
Well, fortunately, I had a very large hand in the development of the law. The commissioner at the time used to joke and say that the legislature should actually be paying my salary because I work almost every day. And, but, you know, I felt it was very important to be front and center to make sure that we steered this policy in the right direction.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And I worked hand in glove with the health department and more importantly with the advocates so that we really wove together the best of the best, stretching each of us to come together and to provide the best medical care we can for this, for the state and for this population. So, but to your point, we do offer all three FDA approved medications. And, you know, again, this was somewhat easy to do because of the philosophy that we all agreed to support,
right,
which is that our belief was that the decision about medicating and which medication is right for someone should, just like in the community, solely be between a qualified provider and a patient. And then number two, because historically we had less than 30 inmates at any given time on methadone, and we knew this because of all of our pilots and evaluations, that we could quickly collaborate with the already established community-based hub and spoke system that Vermont is also famous for, to facilitate assessment and induction on methadone using a DEA-approved guest dosing process. And so the department, you know, in the enormity of this task, we didn't need to lift up our own opioid treatment program. The acronym for that is an OTP, which needs both a SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, and DEA accreditation and licensure. So that was like a whole bureaucratic and like developmental piece that we didn't need to do because we decided to partner with something that was already in place. Right. And we did the analysis that at statewide with the health department that we felt that, you know, that system had the capacity to treat our people. Like our people were probably their people. Most of them were probably already in their system, which of course you'll hear me maybe later on comment on that, but that ended up actually being true.
Okay.
So we were not, because they were terrified that we were going to like be loading up, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, you know, into their system and we would break their system by using the hub and spoke, but that ended up not being the case.
Can you elaborate a little bit on the hub? I've read about the hub and spoke quite a bit, but for our listeners, can you elaborate a little bit about the hub and spoke approach?
Yes, absolutely. So first, you know, typical Vermont, I call it only in Vermont, OIV. We were very late at the table, but then caught up real fast. So what I mean by that is late at the table is that I think we were the second to last state in the country, which is so contrary to our progressive, you know, philosophies and general practice, in offering methadone. Then through the hub and spoke system and a real shift in policy, we caught up real fast because our vision with that was to penetrate every area of the state to address the opioid crisis and to provide as much access to care as we possibly could. So we stood that up with this hub and spoke system, whereby we have hubs, designated hubs, that are the OTPs I talked about earlier.
Right.
They provide methadone and buprenorphine and the counseling and psychosocial support services. But those tend to be where people who are more complex may start because they need that intensity of service delivery. And then once they stabilize, if they're on buprenorphine, they are transferred to less intensive office-based treatment programs called OBOTs, which are the spokes.
Right.
So it's like you know, it's just like a wheel.
Hub
and then the spokes.
Right.
And sometimes people come back to hubs because they are not thriving, you know, with less monitoring that they might receive in a spoke. They might come back to a hub, or they might not do well in a hub and be transferred to a spoke. So it's fluid in both directions. That being said, if you're on methadone, you must go to an OTP, which is a hub. And then unless you change medications, if your treatment and your well-being and recovery allow for that, you have to get your care at a hub. And then you get more and more sort of freedom from the hub as you stabilize.
Okay.
And your amount of medication and length of time for take-home medication is increased.
Okay.
So that's a short story about the hub and spoke. So we plug into the hubs for continuing methadone, and then we also plug into the hubs upon release, and the same thing with the spokes.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you. I'd read about it before, and I love the way, and I think other states may have the system set up, but I like the analogy of the hub and spoke.
Really, yeah.
I think it's very easy to understand. And I even referenced it in LAPA's Model Act, the MAP Model Act, because I think it's a really easy way for even a lay person to understand how that system would work.
Yeah.
Been some of the benefits? We can talk about the challenges and the benefits, but what have been some of the benefits of implementing the MAP program in the correctional settings?
Well, I think that we definitely have seen benefits. I mean, as I said earlier, originally this work was driven by Vermont's awareness of the opioid crisis.
Right.
And our goal to reach as many people who needed it and would benefit from MAT. So on any given month, our average daily population is about 1,400 plus or minus.
Uh-huh.
And we typically house about 600 people who are on one of the three FDA approved medications. So it's about 40% or so. And then my point here is that about 40 or 50% of those 600 of the 1,400, we inducted while they were in our custody. So we are clearly at the forefront of identifying previously very hard to reach, and what the field sometimes, I don't like this term, but try sort of stigmatizing, say, are treatment resistant people.
Uh-huh.
We have actually had them, talked to them, assessed them, decided they needed this medication. Obviously, they only have to participate in this if they want to, if they so elect to do so. But we have half of this 600 people in any given time we have inducted and are hopefully part of a future working group to help support them on their recovery.
How's your program so good at it? What are some of the things that you do?
Well, I think, again, part of our philosophy, which is so somewhat antithetical to what I think people who are involved in criminal justice or who are incarcerated think, is that our treatment, our MAT treatment, is basically on demand. If you meet medical necessity, you can at any time during your incarceration, regardless of your legal status, be considered for an assessment. And if you meet medical determination, you can elect to be on it. So I think that very open stance has helped people decide to take a step forward and learn whether or not they could benefit from this. I've actually gotten your question from other national stakeholders because they've said to me, well, what incentives did you offer the inmates? And I was like, incentives? We don't offer them any incentive except potential for recovery and wellness.
Right.
You know, we try to destigmatize this, make it just like part of regular healthcare that they can ask these questions, talk to a provider about this and decide if this is right for them.
Okay.
So I would say that's part of how we've done this really well. I think what's really, really interesting, and again, back to your question about benefits, is that we are working in collaboration with our state Medicaid agency to evaluate MAT treatment retention post-release by tracking those we inducted and those we continued by medication type. So to date, the analysis is very positive. So that means that the initial analysis of the treatment retention after they've left our facility
is
incredibly strong. So this is really looking to be a very promising practice in criminal justice reform, that offering this treatment inside of a facility really can translate to people managing this chronic disease once you're back in the community.
Wow. That's fascinating. You're right. You do hear numbers like that. And you're like, what incentive could be offered? It's like, well, you know, getting treatment. That
is it. Being sick and tired of your lifestyle and withdrawing and being sick and having to, do something possibly criminal to get the money, to get the drugs. I mean, the whole cycle. So if we can really interrupt that, you know, obviously this is going to be really important information.
Right. I wanted to ask, how is your program funded? How do you fund all this amazing work that you're doing?
Yeah, so well, initially, the money that funded the program after Act 176 was, of course, as is typical, you know, one-time money. It was a little tobacco money. It was a little this. It was a little that. Then, fortunately, our Department of Health had received federal SOAR money, and I think that they. Again, implementation sometimes with all these initiatives is difficult. Large system change is difficult. And obviously, we hope to make use of monies as effectively and efficiently as possible. And so when they knew that and were watching our implementation, you know, we had a mutual interest in supporting each other. And so through an MOU with the health department, they transferred a significant amount of money to us in that second year. Currently now, it is a cost in our base budget, and it is embedded in our healthcare contract.
Okay.
So while it's always a struggle because now the department has this obligation legally to balance our overall budget, we are a little bit more protected in that it's within the healthcare contract, and we must provide this by law. So unless somebody wants to change the law, and certainly we compel the healthcare contractor to deliver the system, the services as efficiently as possible.
You
know, it's really part of healthcare, and you can't tease it out.
Right. And also by making it by statute, you makes a longer process for having to change it. You can advocate for why this is a cost savings measure, which I want to ask, is it a cost savings measure?
So we haven't got, our evaluation is ongoing. But, you know, the cost savings and the definition of that is obviously the devil's in the details.
Right.
So I know that people are often curious about, you know, well, does this reduce recidivism? And my comment on that is multi-level, multi-layered. You know, recidivism is a state law in Vermont, as it is in most states. And we all have different definitions.
Right, right,
so,
for sure.
You know, I like to think about it more as return to incarceration and not necessarily as recidivism. But that being said, there are so many reasons why somebody returns to incarceration that are, again, also very state law specific. So all of these factors have to be part of a definition of value-based medicine analysis and cost savings. So I think, again, my prophecy here is that because we are retaining people in treatment, we're probably going to be able to prove a reduction in emergency room visits.
Right. And, yeah.
You know, other healthcare issues that are associated, like hepatitis C, et cetera, in this treatment. So that's an added part of our evaluation with our Medicaid agency, is we're going to be also adding in hepatitis C and other chronic diseases that are associated with this. And we're going to be looking at the impact on the Medicaid population over time. So I have no doubt that eventually there will be cost savings. I just can't definitively say after just 2 years, which really is more like a year and a half, because the ramp up obviously was very steep. Even though we were already engaged in this, but I think eventually that will become clearer.
And I think research takes time. I think
it does.
Evidence takes time. It wouldn't be good practice for you to come out with something and said, after 6 months, we've said this.
No,
so
I mean,
I understand.
Part of that, literally, in my learning, which has been so interesting, is that it even depends collecting the Medicaid data. Pharmacy claims are processed right at the time of the delivery of the service.
Right.
But induction, assessment, ongoing care are typically bundled rates of services and may not be billed for 6 months. So even the data itself doesn't show up in the systems to even be evaluated in a timely manner.
Right. So, that makes sense.
You know, these are very complicated large systems to make sure that your data definitions, how you're correlating the data, and how you're making sure that that data is actually representative of the research question you have. It's again, a very complicated task.
What are some of your biggest challenges and how have you overcome it with this program?
Oh, yes, there are always challenges, aren't there? Well, life wouldn't be fun without challenges. I think the first challenge, which is kind of basic and obvious, is that large system change is never easy. So I know that sounds very simple, but it's obviously a very big concept. No matter how much buy-in you may have, and as I already said, you know, I certainly did have more buy-in in my state that maybe, you know, other states might start with.
Right.
But change is hard. Change is very hard.
Yeah.
And we also, I think another big challenge, and I think this is really universal and is definitely an ongoing issue, as is the change management, is stigma. There is still a tremendous amount of stigma about opioid use disorder, substance use disorders, and certainly about medication-assisted treatment. And we certainly saw that from, you know, at the security side, the health provider side. Just because somebody's a health provider, everybody does not necessarily buy into this thinking.
That's
we have
true.
An aging health provider population, a helper population, I think, nationally in almost every field. And all of those people were educated at different times, much earlier. Science is a paradigm that's always evolving. And, you know, they weren't brought up in this. And so they have their doubts and their biases. And then I'd also say the stigma also is in the inmate population, the general public, legislature, you know, other stakeholders. It's an ongoing education process.
How do you combat that? How do you combat stigma?
I think being a leader is holding a positive vision and not being deterred from what you have conviction and strong beliefs. So I try to embody and uphold that vision everywhere I go, maintaining an open stance of curiosity and also exercising my leadership, which is to try to educate whenever possible.
Right.
But also to really listen and to not discount people who disagree.
Right.
So I think that if that consistently happens over time, people have their own personal and lived experiences.
Yeah.
And that you start to see, you know, micro shifts towards the other. You know, we stop othering so much. And we start seeing that, well, it might still not work for me. This might not be what I want. But I can see that if others, you know, this helps other people, well, then yes, who am I to be in judgment of that? So I think that process has to happen constantly at every level. And so I just try to take every opportunity I can to engage.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense in terms of keeping an open line of communication. Is there any way, or do you have any suggestions for people who grapple with maybe concerns about changing the stigma about medication for addiction treatment in the public, for officials that are listening? That was one of the concerns that we grapple with when we were writing the MAT Act. Mm-hmm. Writing our own model act, because that is, like you mentioned, that is a concern, because these are people who call their legislators, who are like, you know, wondering, why is this person getting drugs in prison? Mm-hmm. When, you know, do you have any suggestions? Have you seen anything that you think would help with that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to condense this out of everything I've studied and learned in my own personal experience of, you know, what I think is helpful. And again, what might be helpful in one situation, you know, is not helpful in another. So you have to have a variety of different talking points to address different audiences.
But
I think, simply put, you know, when it really comes down to it, this is about healthcare parity. And understanding that whether it's a substance use disorder or a mental illness, that these things are as real as a broken leg. And that people take medications for high blood pressure. They take medications for asthma. They take medications for things that are chronic and are never going to go away because we haven't discovered a cure. And they take medications for things that pop up in their life like an earache. We have science to direct us in this, and the science is solid on the treatment of mental illness and on substance use disorder. And we know that there are best practices and frontline treatments that don't work for everybody, but should be tried first. And then there are a cascade of other treatments underneath that, and that everybody has to find what works for them. So I think that's my overall, what I would overall offer policymakers and people in state government. And then I'd back that up by saying that methadone is literally the most researched drug, probably because of the stigma.
Right.
In the world. And the World Health Organization has it listed as one of the essential medications worldwide. You know, This is not snake oil.
Right.
This is a medication that is recognized at every level of medical system and policy as being effective in the treatment of this disorder. Buprenorphine is the newer medication to the table. But that being said, the overall practice of treating this disorder with these medications is really the gold standard.
I think that's such a great point. And with all that said, how is COVID, our pandemic impacted your program? How has it impacted? I know that we were initially supposed to have you as a guest on our podcast, and then COVID happened. And I think everyone was just sort of scrambling to deal with that. How has that played out? How has that impacted the correctional settings? How has that impacted Matt, how has that impacted you? It's unprecedented.
Absolutely. So first, I remember that conversation that we had, and I was so unbelievably excited, over the moon, to be asked to do this podcast. And then really COVID life happened. And I can remember me telling you, oh my God, I simply can't do this. I'm choking. So yes, that was my personal experience of just being overwhelmed of the magnitude of what this actually meant in terms of the way my work needed to change, the way I did my work, and then how the work of corrections and keeping people safe was going to change. And I don't think it really dawned on any of us in Vermont or nationally the magnitude and what the impact was really going to be. I mean, and maybe thank God we didn't understand it at that point, because I think we would have just been frozen in trauma. But I also want to say that the biggest impact has been on the people we care for, our inmates, because these are people whose liberties have already been limited. And then COVID limited their liberties even further, of course, in the guise of protecting them. But, you know, I think we all got a taste with quarantine and the restrictions our states put on us, rightly so, of right. what it's like to have our liberties limited. So it certainly doesn't come close to what an inmate experiences, but I think it is kind of a profound paradigm reversal that we should all think about.
Right. That's a good point.
That being said, you know, we had some positive COVID tests in one of our facilities. There was an outbreak. And we, thank goodness, had incredible leadership and multidisciplinary teams who acted on containment. But containment, it sounds like a very simple phrase. What people don't understand in a correctional system is that actually equates to different stages of lockdown. You know, when you are trying to limit movement in a facility, that means that facilities are locked down, units are locked down, which means people don't go anywhere in a prison where they don't go anywhere anyway.
Right. My gosh. So, yeah. Never think about that.
Yeah. So this was really, really difficult. And I have to say that the resilience of our inmates was incredible. There were very few serious disciplinary violations during this period of time. They were so incredibly patient. It just blew me away.
Wow.
Yeah. And people really pulled together, and there was somewhat sympathy, I think, empathy created across the aisle, and recognition that the department, no matter what they did, we were really trying to save lives and to make people safe. And I think they had forgiveness in the tactics that we had to use, that they knew that they weren't just being punished, that
because it was a pandemic,
trying to save their lives. Yeah.
It was unprecedented pandemic.
It was unprecedented. And we were all trying to figure this out in real time. And there was a tremendous amount of patience in the system. That being said, obviously, and we know this from being in the community, in the beginning of the pandemic, I mean, everything froze. People in the community couldn't go to their doctors or special care providers to get care. So, I mean, again, that the same thing happened on the correctional side. We were not able to deliver any services in a group congregate setting. We were completely limited in our ability to transport to offsite medical services unless they were absolutely deemed urgent and emergent. Everything stopped. So really specific to our topic today, I'll give you an example. Like this was this is the weak side of using the hub and spoke model, because we're not an OTP. People who we determined should actually be transferred onto methadone and inducted on methadone couldn't be, because the DEA still has not relaxed and will not relax their requirement that methadone induction has to be done face-to-face. And because of that, we were limited and we could not, in the early stage of this, transport people to a methadone clinic to be inducted. The assessment, the assessment could be done through telehealth, but the actual induction has to be done face-to-face. So we're just now creating protocols to address this. The policies are just about to be approved, and we're going to be starting to transport inmates to the hubs to become inducted. That's an example of the direct impact. And of course, there are many others. I do a lot of my work with inmates in the facilities. I was no longer allowed to go. Think of the correctional officers terrified, going in and out every day. And then especially when we had positive outbreaks, transmitting that to maybe vulnerable family members who had cancer or other issues. I mean, this is just social connection and constant contact tracing. And we housed our staff in hotels for a very long period of time while we were containing these positive outbreaks. We have a schedule now where we do regular testing on a rotating basis, developing quarantine units, step-down units, medical isolation units. I mean, it's just added a whole nother dimension to, you know, disease.
Wow. I can't even, I laud you for you. Every time I talk to you, including on this, you're always positive, always, I'm serious, always focused, always positive. And I laud you for that. I just have a one or two more questions. What advice would you give someone who's maybe in the heading a correctional settings program or interested in creating or implementing a medication for addiction treatment program? What advice would you have in terms of starting that or looking to start one?
Well, I'll give you my advice, but first I want to tell you what it's based on because it's really about my beliefs.
Okay.
And I strongly believe that it is imperative to provide the best and most robust healthcare in corrections, not the least, not what we can get by with. Because while people are incarcerated, if we are providing the best healthcare, we are actually reducing the impact of healthcare disparities that our population has most certainly experienced throughout their lifetimes in their communities. So this is really about addressing a long time wrong and having a place in time, probably adversely what is the worst place in time because they're incarcerated, but having some good come out of that. I really, really strongly believe that. This is about reducing healthcare disparities. My advice is to pay attention to national policy experts like LAPA.
Thank
Number
you.
One, you know,
Thank you.
Go to the source. Number two, seek technical assistance. Don't try this on your own. You're not alone. Many criminal justice related entities like LAPA are helping states move forward. I mean, the American Correctional Association, Bureau of Justice, the National Governors Association, the National Council on Behavioral Health, ASAM. I mean, there are so many who have promulgated incredible compilations of best practices and position papers, et cetera. And it is just so important to align yourself with others who are thought leaders on this and who are really at the forefront of championing these efforts. And in turn, giving a voice to those who are doing the work, you know, like we're speaking here today.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, the total sum of my advice is to be as bold and visionary as possible because we need compassionate justice and delivering MAT and corrections should be part of that vision.
That's wonderful. And I completely agree with you. I think that's absolutely wonderful. And I think part of what you said, aside from, because the seek advice, I think, and you've been great in terms of LAPA and working with us on the Model Act. And we're going to hopefully putting out our Model Act will help others in laying out groundwork for that. But I think seeking advice has been something that I've seen. And I'm coming as someone who has not worked in the substance use and substance use disorder, I guess, industry or program for that long. But it seems like a lot of people kind of do their own thing in their own spheres. And I imagine that is not maybe the most productive way. I definitely don't want to offend anyone.
No, but I mean, I kind of compare it to, you know, again, what I said earlier, that admitting you have a problem or a need is
right.
actually a sign of strength.
Right. It's a great way of putting it. Right.
Asking for help is a strength and a skill to ask for help.
Right.
And then you have to ask for help. You have to know what help you need and you have to ask the right people.
Right.
Because asking
That's
the true. Wrong people who aren't going to help you just creates frustration. But asking for help is a good thing. And it's similar to, you know, you could learn how to ski or sail or ride a horse, but trying that on your own might be very complicated and might not have the result. But asking for a teacher, a mentor, somebody to monitor you, my gosh, makes the learning go that much faster and is much more rewarding. And you're more likely to reach your goal than trying it on your own.
That's a great point. And for people who want to talk to you or get a little bit more one-on-one with you, we're going to provide a link to your information if that's okay. But how can they reach out to you? What's the best way? Are you on social media, LinkedIn? What would you prefer?
So I am on LinkedIn, but I, again, old school, I'm not so much with social media. So I mean, I think direct contact either by phone or my email at vermont.gov would be fantastic, because I think that my department also really recognizes the benefits of leadership and mutuality. And while I'm certainly not here to do other people's work, I think that providing guidance is part of being a leader.
Thank you so much. And thank you for talking to me today. I found it very, very interesting and very helpful. Well, that's all the time we have for today. I want to thank you to Director Ram Nassiano of the Vermont Department of Corrections for her wonderful and insightful interview. And I want to ask that you, our listeners, join us for our next one-on-one with LAPA, where we'll be discussing another interesting topic. In the meantime, if you would like to learn more about medication for addiction treatment, especially in correctional settings or in general, log on to legislativeanalysis.org. That's one word, legislativeanalysis.org, or contact LAPA at info@thelapa.org. And don't forget, LAPA will be releasing a model state law on the implementation of medication for addiction treatment in October 2020. Have a great day. Thank you for joining us.